Virginia Prescott, and you're listening to a special archived edition of Word of Mouth.
Every time I see that lonesome railroad train.
What is it that makes trains so romantic? Air and car travel have turned these engines of American mobility and prosperity into mostly charming, mostly expensive relics. 98% of Americans have never boarded a city-to-city train, leaving them to chug along in old country songs and some remarkable movies. Still, worldwide, 100 million people board a train each weekday morning, and trillions of tons of cargo travel by rail each year. Global commerce would crash without trains. Author and journalist Tom Zellner boarded trains in Russia, China, India, the UK, the US, Peru, and Spain to get an up-close look at the network of railways that connect the world. We spoke with him earlier this year for the publication of his book, Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World. It's now available in paperback. It is your own experience of the romantic nature of trains that in some way launched this book. Care to share that?
Yes. This was a kind of both a visual and an audio experience for me. When I was a kid in Kansas during the summers, I would hear the sound of a train whistle through the window at night. And it just was the most mysterious, the most lovely, kind of the most haunting thing that I had ever heard. And to this day, I think there's almost no sweeter music than a train whistle. And then many years later, I was riding an Amtrak through Pennsylvania during a snowstorm, and which is a really equally sort of like mysterious and kind of almost exotic kind of thing to go through. And across the aisle from me was a young woman reading a book. And she was kind of crying, actually. She was, whatever it was that she was reading had so moved her that it was kind of, bringing her to tears, as some good reading experiences can do that to us. And the motion of the carriages and the snow outside the window and the light overhead, it was just an amazing image. If I could paint, I would have painted it. And to me, there just seemed something so intrinsic to train travel about that image, and I've never quite forgotten it.
Well, you never spoke to her, but you do talk to plenty of strangers throughout your travels in the book. And you also speak to this combination that you were just referring to, the sound and the sway, this distinct but ineffable feeling of being on a train. You call it, in some points, the train sublime, that often leads strangers to talk with each other. What is that?
It's the freedom that you mentioned earlier. It's the freedom of movement within the train carriage that allows you to sort of, pass from space to space easily. It's not like an airplane where it's awkward and it's sterile and, most of us fly without ever exchanging a word with the person next to us, because it just sort of feels like a strange invasion of privacy. But, the walls are somewhat down on a train. It's friendlier. It's more communal. It's just an eminently civilized way to travel.
And, of course, you can walk to the bar car.
There you go, and that always makes it go down easier.
Trains still run in this American collective unconsciousness, and certainly the British, despite, as you point out to us, Brit Rail being pretty much eviscerated first in the 1960s, later in the 90s. You began your journey there in Great Britain. Why?
It is the motherland of trains. It is where the train was invented, in the coal fields of northern Yorkshire. And it was invented as a device to get coal out of the mines and into the cities. And what it did, much more than that, it kickstarted the Industrial Revolution. This was the world's first real machine. And there were press reports all over Britain of people seeing a locomotive for the very first time and almost going catatonic. Hmm. The human mind just didn't have room for this, This kind of weird spider-like thing sitting on the rails, that was huffing and puffing like, something that was alive. And so people ran away from it. When they would ride it, they would experience this kind of weird cognitive shock, the experience of traveling at 25 miles an hour was foreign to the consciousness, and the landscape sort of flickering by, and it really made an incredibly deep impression on the people who wrote it.
And that was back in England in 1825 when it was introduced. How does that train narrative compare the American and the British?
When it came to the early construction, the British philosophy was to blast through the hills, you know, use dynamite to level out the track and to build the track very well. We Americans, by contrast, with a more mountainous country and with more of a profit imperative, did it very quickly. And so when British surveyors came over and saw the sort of kind of helter-skelter construction that their Yankee cousins were building, they said, you know, my gosh, old chap, what is this junk you're putting up? And the Americans would say, well, you know, Limey, you're doing it a little too slow. Mm-hmm. And so the experience of riding British rail was far smoother back in the 19th century.
We're speaking with Tom Zellner about the rich, imaginative, economic, and social history of the train. He's got a new book out called Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World from the Trans-Siberian to the Southwest Chief. Well, Tom, let's talk a little bit about it, trains in the American imagination, because we have so many unofficial poets laureate of train travel, one of them being Johnny Cash. Here he is in the 1974 documentary called Riding the Rails, The Great American Train Story.
You know, there's nothing that stirs my imagination like the sound of a steam locomotive. That lonesome whistle cutting through the night, and that column of black smoke and steam throwing shadows across the land. When I was a boy, the trains ran by my house, and they carried with them a promise that somewhere down the track, anything would be possible.
Johnny Cash, of course, you cite some of that literature in those country songs and blues songs from, you know, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison to these blues songs where the train is the bringer and the taker of love and sex and objects of desire and a way out. And you even relay a story that suggests that waiting for a train was the birthplace of the American blues. Can you tell us that story?
It was indeed. And not just the American blues, but the antecedent to all American popular music. And the cradle for this was the Mississippi Delta, where the field calls that the slaves and the sharecroppers would call to each other, this got mechanized, if you like. It was the railroad that ran through that rich agricultural region that made such a deep impression on the musicians. And so W.C. Handy, the great blues musician, relates the story of being in a railway station after midnight in the Yazoo Valley and hearing the strangest kind of music being played by a stranger with a guitar who was crooning on about where the Southern crossed the dog. That was the lyric that he was singing, and this made such an impression on Handy, the fusion of field calls with this rhythmic da-dump, da-dump, da-dump of the train. And so when you dig underneath American popular music, you're going to find railroad tracks underneath that.
W.C. Handy recorded Yellow Dog Blues with his band, but we also have a version of Sam Collins here recorded somewhere between 1927 and 31, playing it on a guitar.
Been out there for riding, and I didn't want to ride no train. I want to ride the Yellow Dog, well, why did Mary Jane?
So as well as being an engine of social change, rail also emblematic of power, at least the lines conquering land and human spirit in many cases, certainly in the building of the Qinghai-Tibet Railway, the world's highest rail line, built with great determination by the Chinese. Why is this so symbolic?
Because it is a railroad that is not so much economic as political. The question of Tibetan independence has been sensitive and contentious for more than 70 years. And with this railway, which was built at enormous expense, and it truly is a marvel of engineering, it makes it very difficult to think of an independent Tibet, because this is such a conveyance for people and ideas and commerce into that region that no highway ever could have provided.
And this is part of China's $400 billion investment in linking its super fast bullet trains and all sorts of connections all over the country. Besides a big power move in Tibet, what is it saying to the rest of the world?
It's saying that the Chinese are placing a bet that there will be continuing questions of energy in our future, that we cannot rely on an endless supply of oil, and that this is an energy-efficient and durable and reliable means of getting people to work and goods to market.
We do learn a lot about this tug-of-war over high-speed rail here in the U.S., especially California. You know, people are making the case for crumbling schools and deteriorating highways and against this sometimes apocalyptic scenario laid out by environmentalists if we don't have rail. Now, in all of these trains that you rode and all of these people that you spoke to, what have you learned about making the case for the existence and vibrance of rail here in the U.S.?
Right now, the political support for rail is primarily sentimental. It's those who recall the days when passenger rail was the way to get around, when it was more dignified and luxurious. You know, it sort of exists in sort of a ghost state, although, you know, I take it and enjoy it, you know, frequently as I can. In fact, when I lived in New Hampshire, when I lived in Hanover, whenever I would travel south, I would always try and take the Vermonter, which dropped off in White River Junction, Vermont. It's a wonderful train. It's a bit slower than the interstate. I'm not going to lie about that. But
it's about 10 hours, if I remember.
Yes. You've got to have a leisurely schedule. But if you like American landscape, and if you like seeing sort of the DNA, if you will, of our country, of how we built and of how particularly New England was settled, there really is no finer ride.
You know, Tom, I'm thinking of, you know, Bessie Smith singing about a train taking her love away, or George Gershwin, who apparently we find in your book composed Rhapsody in Blue based on listening to train rides. These are songs from another era, and they do have this kind of ghostly, nostalgic sense. Do trains belong to another time?
No. This is a technology which has never truly lost its edge. As far as efficiency of moving goods, you cannot do better. The physical trick of moving steel wheels on smooth rails, you can coast tons of material along that surface for pennies worth of oil. It's really quite marvelous. And the train turns out to be something that's really hard to improve. The discoveries of 1825 remain vibrant today. We do a miserable job with passengers, but as far as cargo is concerned, we actually do a great job.
Journalist, writing professor, and author of four previous nonfiction books, Tom Zellner, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Now, you can also find much more about Tom's newest book, Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World, from the Trans-Siberian to the Southwest Chief, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Georgia. Said he's